From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. State wildlife officials are rethinking the policies surrounding the recovery of the Florida panther. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission recently proposed changing its guidelines. Environmental groups are reacting strongly and criticizing the plan. We'll look at how the proposal differs from the current plan and why the FWC thinks it's time to make a change. Plus, despite decreasing crime rates, prison costs in Florida have nearly quadrupled since the early 1980s. On the heels of President Obama's recent commutations of the sentences of 46 inmates for nonviolent drug offenses, we explore the impact of mandatory minimum sentencing laws in Florida. First, this news.
Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. On July 13th, President Barack Obama commuted the sentences of 46 people, mostly serving long prison sentences for nonviolent drug-related offenses. Their sentences are now set to end November 10th. 11 of those people are in Florida, including one here in Fort Myers. In his video message announcing the commutations, President Obama said, quote, "These men and women were not hardened criminals, but the overwhelming majority had been sentenced to at least 20 years. 14 of them had been sentenced to life for nonviolent drug offenses, so their punishment didn't fit the crime. And if they'd been sentenced under today's laws, nearly all of them would have already served their time," end quote. The move has prompted advocates rather to encourage state officials to review sentencing policies here in Florida. Florida Tax Watch's Robert Weissert points out that Florida prison costs have nearly quadrupled since the early 1980s, even though crime rates are actually down. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics National Prisoner Statistics Program, in 2013, Florida had the third highest adult prison population of any state, behind only Texas and California, and that Florida ranked ninth in the nation when it comes to the number of incarcerated citizens per capita. For the remainder of the hour, we'll be exploring Florida's mandatory minimum sentencing policies and efforts to increase judicial discretion. Joining me now is Democratic State Representative Katie Edwards. She represents State House District 98, which includes eastern portions of Broward County. Edwards serves on the House Judiciary Committee, and in 2014, she successfully championed a measure through the legislature aimed at returning some judicial discretion to the criminal courts in some drug trafficking cases. Representative Edwards, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
We're joined by Greg Newbern. He's the state policy director for the advocacy organization Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Thanks for being with us, Greg.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we're also speaking with Kathleen Smith. She's the public defender for Florida's 20th Judicial Circuit, serving Charlotte, Collier, Glades, Hendry, and Lee counties. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for the invitation.
And I invite listeners to join our conversation as well. Connect with our guests with a phone call to 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Post comments or questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media, or follow the live Twitter feed using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Greg, let's begin with you. Tell us generally about Families Against Mandatory Minimums. What is the mission or goals, and who are your supporters?
Sure. FAM was created in 1991 by our current president, Julie Stewart, after her brother was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison for a very small-time marijuana growing operation. He had no prior criminal history, no violence in his past, came from a good family, well-educated. And he made the stupid decision to grow marijuana in his house and was busted for it. And his family and everyone, all of his friends, thought he would get a slap on the wrist, maybe a light jail sentence or something to send a message. But federal mandatory minimum laws required that he go to prison for 5 years. And Julie, at the time, was working at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., and had not really followed these sorts of issues previously, but left her job at Cato and started Families Against Mandatory Minimums. And since then, we've led the fight for fair and proportionate sentences, all consistent with public safety, obviously, to try to use tax dollars more wisely in criminal justice. And we work at the federal level, we work at the state level, and I'm here in Florida trying to do the same thing.
It looks like FAM is particularly active here in Florida. Your website indicates that some of the most severe mandatory minimum drug laws in the country are here in the Sunshine State. How so? Tell us about that.
I think that's right. Yeah, we actually have some of the most draconian drug sentences, and particularly with respect to prescription painkiller pills. What we have are mandatory sentences for drug trafficking. And usually when someone thinks of drug trafficking, they think of someone like Pablo Escobar, someone who's bringing in a boatload of cocaine into a Miami harbor or something. But in reality, our drug trafficking laws are written in such a way that very small amounts can trigger mandatory prison sentences. And when you talk about painkiller pills, you're only talking about a handful of pills. It was seven, but thanks to the leadership of Rep. Edwards and others in Tallahassee, we've reformed that a bit, but it's still low. So the problem was the unintended consequence of writing a law where the trafficking threshold rates were so low that we were sweeping in thousands of people who were simply addicted to painkiller pills, but calling them traffickers because they happened to have possessed more than the relevant trafficking threshold. So between 1999 and 2014, we locked up thousands of very low-level, nonviolent drug offenders, folks with no criminal history, many of whom never sold pills at all, but merely possessed them, and we put them in prison for 3 years, 15 years, and sometimes even 25 years. You can have as few as 44 pills, a few days' supply for an addict, and get a 25-year prison sentence. That's been reformed a bit. The laws are better now than they were before, but they're still out of line not only with logic and reason, but also with the rest of the country.
Well, and Greg, you know, the state attorney general office is leading that effort to, you know, crack down on pill mills and all the problems that have been going on with, you know, improper or illicit use of prescription painkiller medicines, you know, working with law enforcement agencies in a coordinated effort all around the state. That's been very, very successful. Is that really where we saw a lot of these laws coming from, or does it go back further than that?
Well, it's actually a really good point because we started with our mandatory minimums for prescription painkillers back in 1999. And from 1999 through about 2011, what we saw was more overdose deaths, more overdoses generally, more drug trafficking arrests, and more prison admissions for drug trafficking, which is to say there was zero deterrence at all from these mandatory minimums. The drug problem got worse, not better. And it was only until about 2011 when the legislature and Attorney General Bondi and the governor got together and said, we need to do something about prescription painkillers because what we've done so far hasn't worked. And that's actually what's been helpful and useful in reducing the overdose deaths, the cracking down on the pill mills, looking for the suppliers. These things have actually had a positive impact on drug use and drug overdose deaths here in Florida, whereas the mandatory minimum sentences, they were this was the whole point. If we do this, then we can get this problem under control, and we won't have these things. Instead, it spiraled out of control until we took a new path, and we passed some laws that actually have started to work a little bit. So I think we have to really look at what works and what doesn't work, and we know that the mandatory minimums didn't do anything that they were supposed to do, whereas the reforms in the last couple of years have been very, very effective.
And let's talk about just mandatory minimum sentences and how they function in terms of impeding judicial discretion. What sorts of factors do you think a sentencing judge should be able to take into account, specifically with these drug trafficking types of cases, that mandatory minimum sentences don't allow them to do?
Sure. And if you look at the history of
Before we had passed the law in 2013, the law did not give the judges any discretion to differentiate between the person who is in mere possession for their own habit, their own addiction, versus the person that was trafficking or selling. So we would treat the bad doctor who was over-prescribing prescription drugs like hydrocodone and oxycodone in ridiculous amounts. We were treating that same person as an addict. And so, you know, when Greg is talking about, you know, the seven hydrocodone pills would trigger a three-year state prison sentence, you'd have to scratch your head and look at that and say, my goodness, is that the best use of taxpayer resources and dollars? And what we're seeing now is a policy shift in Tallahassee where we began talking about not so much the war on drugs, but the war on addiction. And the West Coast in Florida, we're experiencing that now. You know, this is the ravages of the pill mill epidemic. Now that we've done a great job at going after those storefront pill mills and those bad doctors, what are we seeing now? We're seeing those addicts left looking for that next cheap, quick high, and it's heroin. And so it's disturbing when you see counties like Manatee and Sarasota and Palm Beach, they're now grappling with how they deal with these increase in heroin overdoses. And so we're finding, You know, we need to focus the conversation, the policy debate, on allowing judges to look at a person's background and look at the diversion programs to help get these addicts into the type of lifelong programs that they need to keep them healthy, to keep them sober, to keep families intact, and keep them out of our state prisons, which essentially have been warehousing addicts for the last decade.
Representative Edwards, I think you make a good point that the Fort Myers News Press here just reported this week that emergency rooms that are in Lee Memorial Health System hospitals saw 121 heroin overdose cases in 2014 compared to just 15 cases 5 years ago. So it seems like that's something that's just been happening in recent years. But going back to the 2014 state legislative session, can you tell us a bit more about the measure that you and Senator Rob Bradley successfully championed through there? And how did that first come up on your radar? Where did you, you know, hear from families of folks who this had happened to?
Well, actually, this began as a larger sentencing reform effort that for years had been led in a bipartisan fashion with Broward, former State Senator Ellen Bogdanoff, and a former State Representative Ari Porth, who is now serving on the bench in Broward County. And they recognize that we need to overhaul the way that we sentence, drug addicts. And so I committed that once I got elected in 2012 that I would take up the torch and I would make sentencing reform and criminal justice reforms important and make that part of my legacy, because I recognize that, you know, we were sentencing too many folks to jail that were not violent, hardened criminals, that these were addicts who needed help, not prison. And we also recognize that our prison system is not set up to serve these addicts and their families. When you take people out of their environment, they're not able to work, they're not able to be around their family, their loved ones, without any type of substance abuse treatment or counseling, you just return them back to society 3 years later, 7 years later, and what have you accomplished? Nothing. You just, you know, ask the taxpayers to basically spend $30,000 a year to house these individuals, but with no impact on recidivism or on that person's long-term well-being and prosperity. So just recognizing that Florida's approach to the pill mill epidemic was so supply-side focused, we did nothing to address the demand part of that equation, and that's going to be our lifelong challenge, because whether it's addiction to alcohol, to prescription painkillers, to heroin, to now even Flocka, we have got to spend more money getting to the root cause of addiction and help people identify and deal with the underlying abuse and trauma that then triggers someone turning to and developing an addiction.
And a follow-up there, Representative Edwards, can offenders currently serving prison sentences for these type of painkiller trafficking crimes petition for a resentencing if they were sentenced perhaps before your bill was signed by the governor?
I think that our Florida legislature is better equipped and better prepared now to address that type of legislation. Mm-hmm. When you have groups like the Federalist Society, the James Madison Institute, FAM, Human Rights Watch, when you have such a broad spectrum of interest groups coming together and saying, my goodness, we made a mistake, I think that the timing is right for us to go back. I am prepared to file legislation to do just that and to make it a nonpartisan, non-political issue, but focus on the policy behind it and the fiscal savings to our state budget. We cannot afford to keep warehousing addicts. We need to recognize the mistakes of that policy, and we need to give a certain population the ability to get the help that they need and get them back into society.
And John, if I could just follow up for a moment about
please.
The drug courts.
Yeah, Kathleen Smith, public defender for our region here. Please, go ahead.
I agree with what Representative Edwards is saying in that we're looking at roughly about $20,000 a year to house people in prison at this point, $65,000 to build a new prison bed when we keep adding to our prison system. Our statistics show us here locally that we can treat people very effectively for about $35 a day in an outpatient setting. And in our jail settings, it's anywhere from $80 to $100 in our local jails. And again, as I said, about $20,000 a year in prison. And when people are being released from prison after their prison sentence, they are reoffending at alarming rates when they receive no treatment. Here in our local drug courts, the biggest problem that we are seeing is that we've got a cap of 150 people in the Lee County Drug Court, and it's lower in the other counties of our circuit, in the 20th Circuit. So we have a need for, I mean, obviously we know there's more than 150 drug addicts in this area. Mm. So capacity to serve these people is a big problem here locally as well. I think the money that we are spending on sending people that, for the most part, are nonviolent offenders to prison could be so much better used if we used it locally for treatment and for expanding capacity of our drug courts and our mental health courts and veterans courts for that matter as well.
And Kathleen Smith, from your position, do you see this happening? I mean, I know we're not going to talk specific numbers here, but just anecdotally, do you see a lot of folks who are in situations where you would like a judge to be able to use certain discretion, you know, ask questions like, is this a person's first offense? Do they need treatment? Their role in the offense? And then they just can't because of these laws.
No, absolutely. We see it every day in court, especially with what Greg was talking about. Low-level offenders, people that this could be first-time offenders, actually, and they get pulled into the system or the minimum mandatory sentencings, which were designed for what I think, you know, might be described as our drug kingpins, but it really missed the mark, and it pulled in a whole bunch of people that are serving these minimum mandatory sentences that have no business. We've had many judges where we will present mitigation to them, and at the end, before the sentence, they express concern, they express disappointment over the fact that they don't have the discretion. And actually, the state attorney has the discretion and has more power than the judge in many circumstances because they're the ones that are deciding what to file. And if they file a case that is more than just a possession or a sale, that falls inside the minimum mandatory, the judges have very little discretion. So we are actually in a situation where I think our founding fathers wanted a balance between the defense and the prosecution, and that's what the judge was. It was the check in the system at that point. And it's kind of switched gears with the minimum mandatories that the prosecutors can be the people that are most in control of the courtroom at this point.
Well, on that issue regarding the power or to make decisions that prosecutors have, I wanted to ask you a question that might be a little bit tangential, Representative Edwards, and that is in reference to a bill that you had filed in the 2015 regular session that would have limited the use of Florida's direct file law, which gives prosecutors instead of judges discretion over whether a juvenile offender is to be charged as a child or as an adult. You know, as we all know, the 2015 session ended early over a budget dispute. I think a lot of legislative measures fell victim to that. But can you tell us more about this Florida's direct file law and how you would like to see it changed?
Certainly, and I appreciate that. Well, yeah, I think for the general public and even for most legislators, I would venture to guess that many people have not heard of direct file or are not aware that for certain offenses, we can give the prosecutor the ability to file adult charges against a juvenile. So imagine the 15 or 16-year-old who maybe commits burglary or some other type of a property-based offense. That prosecutor can then file that individual as an adult. And remember, that teenager, while he's still awaiting trial, is taken out of the judicial setting. He's not receiving his education. He's not receiving social services. He's just awaiting trial. So the setting where we were housing these juveniles, number one, from a safety standpoint and just for due process, was of concern. But I don't think that most people realize that, you know, once we file the information against a teenager and they're prosecuted as such, that person is then branded for life. We all recognize that sometimes kids do stupid things, they make mistakes, Sometimes just that one interaction with a law enforcement officer is all it takes to scare the heck out of that kid and to deter them from any further encounters with law enforcement. There are a variety of factors that go into who commits these types of offenses and why. But the bottom line is that right now, those prosecutors, they hold all the cards in determining how those teenagers will be handled. And there has been so much discretion that it's resulting in disparities amongst the circuits on how we sentence and how we deal with juveniles for these felony offenses. And so from a racial standpoint, from a geographic and demographic standpoint, that was a concern. That's what happens when you give prosecutors too much authority, too much discretion results in these types of selective prosecutions.
And Representative Edwards, in regards to this direct file issue, your bill, I think, got the most attention, but I found at least four other separate bills that seem to address the same issue. Do you see this as a sign that your colleagues in Tallahassee are more open than they have been in the past to looking at these issues and making changes?
I think, you know, part of the bills I file, I find, are usually very controversial and they're very heavy lifts. I don't file Mother's Day resolutions or things or feel-good bills. I mean, I've tackled everything from medicinal marijuana, which became law, the Charlotte's Web bill, to the sentencing reform bill. It was probably one of the most monumental criminal justice reforms in close to a decade. So when I take something on this type of issue, I recognize that, one, you've got to have bipartisan support and buy-in. You got to take the time to educate the people that you serve with to put it in the proper context. You know, for me, how we deal with teenagers, how we deal with them, you know, recognizing that once that juvenile has interacted with the adult prison and the adult juvenile, the adult criminal system, chances are that revolving door, we're going to see them right back again. I have branded that individual for life, and therefore the cost to the taxpayers will be significant because I have foreclosed opportunities to enroll in the military, to get Bright Futures scholarships, to get certain types of jobs. So if I can, at the onset, save that teenager from a life of lawlessness and from interaction with the state correction system, why wouldn't I do that? Why wouldn't I focus on the diversion programs we have, like Pace Center for Girls, for example? There are better ways that we can, at the onset, help keep the recidivism rates low, make better use of taxpayer dollars, treat the issue holistically by bringing the entire family to the table and having that type of a more holistic approach, and making sure that we can give prosecutors some bright line boundaries on the types of cases we think are so egregious where adult sanctions are appropriate, and those that we recognize, you know what, let's divert that individual and give him the first crack at it in the juvenile system.
On the heels of President Obama's recent commutation of 46 inmates' prison sentences, we're exploring sentencing policies here in Florida. We're talking with State Representative Katie Edwards, Greg Newbern with the group Families Against Mandatory Minimums, and Public Defender Kathleen Smith with Florida's 20th Judicial Circuit. You can connect with our guests and join the conversation by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Post comments or questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media, or follow the live Twitter chat using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Greg, I was hoping we could take a look at Florida's 1020 life law, particularly within the context of Florida's broad self-defense policies. Where does FAM stand on that?
Sure. Well, 1020 life was passed again back in 1999, and just like the drug laws were intended to focus on kingpins, the 1020 life law, which mandates a 10-year prison sentence for using a firearm in the commission of a felony, 20 years if you fire it, and 25 to life if you hurt somebody or kill them in the commission of a felony. That was designed to go after a certain category of criminals. It was designed to go after particularly violent criminals who use firearms in the commission of crimes like robbing a convenience store or armed robbery or something like that. And just like the drug laws, there were negative unintended consequences with the drug laws, there are negative unintended consequences of 1020 life as well. The intentions don't necessarily match the results. We were getting cases like people who were firing warning shots, firing into the ground, firing into the air, trying to scare people away who they thought were threats, or merely brandishing a firearm in what they perceived as a threat, someone they thought was going to carjack them or coming up on a dark alley and we were afraid of them or something like that. They'd pull a gun, and then they would get arrested and charged with aggravated assault. Well, if you brandish a firearm, and you're charged with aggravated assault, that's a 3-year mandatory minimum prison sentence. And if you fire the weapon, it's 20 years. So we were getting people who were firing warning shots and then being sentenced to 20 years in prison because they were going to trial, they were alleging self-defense, and they were losing. Well, we do have very broad self-defense laws in Florida. We encourage people to take the defense, their defense in their own hands. We have very lax gun laws, and I think it's a good thing. I think citizens should defend themselves, and if they need to, with firearms. So, but the problem is these two laws are in tension with one another. If you, on the one hand, encourage someone to defend themselves with a firearm in the face of a perceived threat, and on the other hand, you hang a 20-year prison sentence over their head if they're mistaken in their belief that someone posed a threat, then you don't really get much of a protection at all. Fortunately, again, with the help of Representative Edwards and others, we were able to fix part of that law again in 2014. Now, because of a bill called the Threatened Use of Force Act that was sponsored by Representative Neil Cumby in the House, a judge does have discretion in aggravated assault cases to take into consideration self-defense as a sentencing factor, and if the judge makes certain findings, can depart from that 20-year sentence. Now, that's a great reform, and it's considerably better than where we were previously, but it doesn't go far enough. There are other crimes that fall under 10-20 life that should be covered under that same, what we call a safety valve, aggravated battery, for instance. So if you perceive a threat and you actually shoot someone, and maybe they were a threat, maybe they weren't, sometimes you go to trial, you get convicted, some get acquitted. It's a coin flip in a lot of these self-defense cases. We should have a judge should be able to take into consideration your self-defense claim at sentencing, no matter what the underlying crime is. Again, it's already on the books for aggravated assault, but we should also add it for other crimes, including aggravated battery, attempted murder, anything where self-defense is a colorable issue.
And Kathleen Smith, I wanted to ask you about this, you know, whether it's the 10-20 life law or whether someone faces a possible mandatory minimum sentence for some other type of crime they've been accused of. Do you ever find yourself or working with folks who are in a position where they could take a plea deal, which would effectively be an admission of guilt, but they don't really think that they are guilty, but going to trial could risk, you know, a two-decade prison sentence?
We really see that on a very regular basis. We will have people that technically could be filed under 10-20 life and are filed under 10-20 life. First of all, it's very, very difficult explaining to the clients some of the actions that Greg just described. They're in disbelief, quite frankly, that they could be facing 10-20 life based on what they did. Because for the most part, we're seeing a lot of really law-abiding citizens that are doing these types of actions that Greg just described. So when you have to sit down with people and explain the extent of what they're looking at and then talk to the state attorney about it and get them to agree maybe to file a lesser charge where they would be placed on probation and have a serious discussion with them about the amount of risk or the amount of exposure that they are setting themselves up for if they decide to go to trial with no guarantees, it's a really tough decision, and it leaves a bad taste in many people's mouths to have to plead to something, because at the same time we're explaining to them the exposure, we have to explain to them what is going to happen as a result of the fact that they're now going to be labeled a convicted felon. So it's, it's the choice between bad and worse in many circumstances, and it doesn't leave defense lawyers feeling good, nor does it leave their clients feeling good. And in most cases, I don't really think it leaves the judges feeling very good about it, too, because, again, as the representative and Greg have pointed out, if we could take the time to explain to the judge who this person is, look at this person as an individual, look at their lack of criminal history, their family ties, their community ties, what this person has done with their life, and all of that's irrelevant when you're looking at a minimum mandatory.
All right. And Greg, I just wanted to quickly step back out from Florida for a minute. I know FAM is advocating for changes at the federal level as well. Can you maybe just quickly go over what some of your positions are regarding proposals in Congress?
Sure. We just had a couple of weeks ago, a bill was introduced. It has 10 Republican sponsors, co-sponsors, and 10 Democratic co-sponsors. Folks like Representative Sensenbrenner, who's been in Congress forever, a very conservative Republican, a top on crime guy, a prime sponsor of this bill. And it's called the Safe Justice Act. And really, it may be the best criminal justice reform bill FAM has seen since 1991. Speaker Boehner just recently came out and said he'd like to see it voted on the floor. It's got a lot of support among Republicans in the House and the Senate, and Democrats, too. And it will reform sentencing laws. It would do some things on recidivism and reentry. It's a really comprehensive criminal justice reform package, the likes of which we really haven't seen in a long time. There are other sentencing reform bills in Congress. The Smarter Sentencing Act is one that's been kicking around for a couple of years. FAM is a supporter of that. That's a bill by Rand Paul and Mike Lee and Ted Cruz, who have all joined the effort to reform federal mandatory minimum sentences for all the reasons that we've described here. It's a true bipartisan moment for criminal justice reform in a way that I'm not sure could be described with any other issue, either in Washington or in the states across the country. I mean, this is truly an issue where Republicans and Democrats and conservatives and liberals, Tea Party people and progressives all come together without sacrificing their principles and saying, we've got to do something about this because we can just be a lot smarter about it than what we have for the last couple of decades. And we're hopeful that we'll get something done both at the federal level and in the state.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show. But thanks so much to our guests, State Representative Katie Edwards, Kathleen Smith, and Greg Newburn. Great to speak with you all.
Thank you.
Democratic State Representative Katie Edwards represents State House District 98 in Broward County. Kathleen Smith is public defender for Florida's 20th Judicial Circuit. And Greg Newburn is with Families Against Mandatory Minimums. There's more information on today's show, as well as an archive of past shows at our website, wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. To comment on anything you've heard on this or any edition of the program, send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Thanks to my producers Luke Martin and Richard Chinqui. This is WGCU, Fort Myers, Naples, Sarasota, 90.1 FM, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.